lovers, welcome to Get Real, a podcast hosted by the National Animal Interest Alliance, through which we'll have deeply honest conversations about animal research so we can learn together and make compassionate choices about our medical future together. Welcome to episode 28 of Get Real. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real, and I have an important question for you. Is love for animals what truly drives the animal rights movement? How did this movement begin, and what is its ultimate goal? Patty Strand, president and founder of the National Animal Interest Alliance, has been studying this movement and sharing her findings publicly for decades. She'll break it all down for us today on Get Real. Patty Strand, thank you so much for joining us today on Get Real. I'm super excited about our conversation today because you are one of my favorite people in the entire world because you love animals so much. We kind of hit it off immediately because we're in the same place when it comes to this. And it's fair to say that most people love animals, and we're naturally then drawn to people or causes that seem to be supporting their well-being. The problem is that our love for animals can sometimes also make us vulnerable to groups who want to exploit that for their own agendas to do things that actually aren't so good for animals, and in many cases, just outright harmful. And that's because there is a huge difference between animal rights and animal welfare. And you are someone who has dedicated decades of your life to helping to clarify this distinction for the public at large across all of our relationships with animals and the many forms that they take because of your work with the National Animal Interest Alliance, for short, NAIA. So I'm looking forward to asking you some questions about your work and the work of NAIA.
Thank you. And the feeling is mutual, I can assure you. It was a natural sort of connection when we met. And that's been a while ago now. It's been like, what, about 10 years? Seems like yesterday. So it's hard to say for sure. I have worked with animals in a completely different setting than you and many other people have. I show dogs. And when you show dogs, it isn't just a matter of going to a dog show and running around a ring. You're actually involved in caring for animals and nurturing animals. You're involved in husbandry. You're involved in hands-on animal care in a way that most of the public is not. I think something like 70% of Americans have a pet of one kind or another. But other than just that relationship that people have with their pets, they've lost their hands-on knowledge of husbandry, which is what the exploitable category is here, right? I mean, if you go back 100 years, people had horses. Everybody understood that they had to take care of the hooves, that they had to do all kinds of things to make sure that the horse that they had was healthy and happy and able to function in the way that they needed that horse to. But in terms of people relying on animals today, it's just pets. So a lot has gotten lost in terms of understanding.
Right. And so you actually, and you're being humble, you breed champion Dalmatians, right? Dogs that we barely ever see anymore, and they're absolutely stunning. Is it your work with Dalmatians and your work breeding animals and this sort of disconnect with the public's perception about breeding that motivated you to start NAIA? Take us through, you know, your motivation for starting NAIA, because you started it back in 1991. I mean, what was going on back then that caused you to create this nonprofit, and what were your main goals at the time?
Well, I would tell you that I had absolutely no intention of starting a nonprofit. I had no idea back in 1988, 89, 90 that I would be doing what I'm doing today. But yeah, I've had this hobby of showing dogs, raising dogs, breeding dogs, caring for dogs for 52 years now. So back then, I was already well over 25 years in this involvement. And we started to see legislation that was overly broad that would have prevented those of us who will responsibly own and breed and care for dogs to be able to continue doing that. I was asked to go down to the legislature and see what this new piece of legislation was all about. It seemed like it might do really good things for us because it was framed as being opposed to puppy mills. And there isn't anybody on the face of the earth that likes the idea of puppy mills, right? So anyway, I went down to the Capitol and I found out that indeed, you know, it was framed in that way, but that it would eliminate everybody's opportunity to breed and care for, and in particular, preserve some of these breeds that we have. So I got down there and I found out that it was what was being called by others in other states that preceded us here in Oregon, an animal rights bill that was aimed at eliminating all breeding. Turned out there was this philosophy that said that any human interaction with animals other than just caring for them, if they were orphans on the street or in shelters, that would be the only proper relationship people could have. So this was a new kind of legislation that was based on the idea that dog breeding of any kind, no matter how humane, no matter how responsible, was just wrong. Ultimately, I got back to the group and I said, yeah, it looks like this particular piece of legislation is a bad one, which means we need to fight it. So I went down and I said, well, you know, we would really like it if you would amend this one little section out so that it only applies to substandard operations, people who are doing it wrong, people who have too many dogs for them to be able to care for properly, or you know, they're not giving them proper vet care. And it turned out that this bill was unamendable. You know, I mean, political science 101 is you go and you get an amendment to a bill to make it better. Well, there was no way to make this better. And it turned out that that was one of the hallmarks of animal rights legislation, is that it was aimed to do a number of things. First of all, achieve the overall goal, which is the elimination of, in this case, dog breeding altogether, not to improve breeding. You know, there's a saying on the research side, we don't want cleaner cages, we want empty cages. And I think, you know, on the dog breeding side of things, they didn't want to improve breeding. They thought it was improper for people to breed animals at all. So long story short, we organized a whole bunch of people, over 100 people went down to the Capitol and complained about this bill. And ultimately, it just died in committee at the end of the session. But during that time, I met a lot of people from different animal backgrounds. I met people from biomedical research. I met people who were involved with sheep growing and other kinds of agriculture. I met people who were involved with fishing and hunting. In other words, I met people who were involved with animal issues in other ways that the animal rights groups did not think should continue, just like dog breeding. And I listened to their stories, and I thought my story sort of paled by comparison. I mean, I met people who had really been the victims of horrific targeting. During the legislative session, by the way, the mink barn at Oregon State University was burned down, so it sort of acted as an exclamation point for what I was seeing. In other words, if I was a little bit distracted by the rest of my life, I kind of couldn't help but notice that there was something bigger going on than just the attack on dog breeding. I had really no intention in 1990 to begin to form any kind of national group. It hadn't gotten to that stage in my mind that I thought I would be doing anything except going back to being, I was a realtor and I showed dogs on the weekend kind of thing. What happened though was that a national dog magazine asked me to write an article kind of describing our experience in Oregon, because in Oregon, unlike some other states around the country, we had been successful in stopping it. And so they thought that it would be really good if I gave sort of a blow-by-blow account for other people to follow of what we did. And I did that. And I also mentioned in passing in the article that there was an animal rights agenda behind this. And I think I might have very briefly said that the animal rights movement has a no animal use philosophy, that it wasn't about doing things better. It was about eliminating human-animal interaction other than, you know, if you could take care of an orphaned animal on the street sort of thing. Anyway, I mentioned it briefly. I didn't mention any names of national groups. However, immediately, the editor of this magazine started getting threats. And he had written for Vanity Fair before he became an editor of this magazine. He was a good writer. He was an accomplished person. He had been around. And all of a sudden, he started to experience attacks on him and his character and his magazine and threats and so on. And he called me up and he said, my God, what is it you're dealing with here? And I had to, you know, share with him what I had learned in the legislature. And we also, my husband and I, started receiving mail too, telling us that we were on the wrong track and so on. No threats at that point for us. I wound up going to a science fair with a young gal I met who was a kidney transplant recipient. She was a really sweet gal, and she had become an advocate for biomedical research. And I went to this science fair with her, and while we were in the booth there, a very skinny, strange-looking guy came up to the booth and started screaming at her for thinking that it was appropriate for her to take the life of animals in order for her to have a kidney, that it was appalling to him. And then he spit right in her face. He literally spit in her. It was the most horrible thing I think at that point I had ever seen. And not just that act, but the hatefulness. I had not seen people that were that consumed by sort of obsessive hatefulness before. I was really moved by that, stunned by that, horrified by that. And I wound up meeting some of her friends and other people that she worked with. And I met some researchers, one that had raised mice for a program up at the University of Washington. And I think it was in the 80s, but he was sitting at his dining room table and a bullet was past their head. He had been receiving mail from people about his work and that it was wrong for him to be doing whatever it is they were guessing he was doing with the mice. And so he was sharing with me that until they moved, that they wound up living in their basement out of fear. So, I mean, I started to recognize that this was way, way bigger than anything that my little hobby ever could have dreamed of. And that's really what motivated me to get involved, because in a free representative kind of government, you can't have this kind of coercion and intimidation going on. You'll change public policy in a direction that is harmful for everyone, including the animals. Interestingly, you know, along that line, the people who have the greatest expertise are the ones who seem to be targeted the most. So anyway, that led us then over a period of the next couple of years. I think in 1991, we sat down with people from agriculture and from research, Dr. Adrian Morrison, who is well respected in the field and had had his own bouts with the animal rights extremists, joined our board. He became one of our first presidents. So we've been involved with research from the very beginning. We had a very unusual group get together. It was interesting. Our name, National Animal Interest Alliance, is one of the most boring names. It's not compelling in any way. And the reason for that is because when we all got together, we had so many prejudices about everybody else that was sitting at the table. Because guess what? All of us have been subject to mainstream media, and the activists associated with the animal rights movement had begun really taking over the conversation about animals using sensationalism and, you know, newsworthy stories, right? Probably since Ingrid Newkirk came to the United States at the beginning of the 80s. And so there was so much focus already that everybody in our group had heard about the other guy that we were leery. We were all looking out of the corner of our eyes. And so in coming up with a name, nobody wanted to come up with a name that inferred anything in particular. It was just like, we're a collection of people that all are involved with animals. And Adrian Morrison finally crystallized it for us. He said, well, I'm here because I know they're lying about me, so I'm willing to believe that they're lying about you. You know, heck of a positive message, right? But really, that's the way it was then.
What's the difference between animal welfare and animal rights? Because I talk to people all the time who say, you know, yeah, I really love animals and they deserve rights. The animal rights people are dead on. They care about animals, right? When I tell people, you mentioned Ingrid Newkirk of PETA, and when I mention some of the things that PETA believes in and some of the harms they've actually caused as a consequence of some of their agendas to people and animals, people look at me like, well, why would they do that? They love animals, right? They're an animal rights group.
I would say that the primary difference between animal rights and animal welfare is that animal rights is an ideological political movement that states as its goal the elimination of animal use by people. And the word use seems kind of negative. When you frame it that way, you might say, well, I don't think animals should be used either. But of course, everybody in society, other than maybe about 2% of the population, do rely on animals. They rely on animals for food. They rely on animals for the medicines that they take. They rely on animals for companionship and the pets they keep. They rely on animals for all kinds of education that allow them to see the natural world more clearly and to be able to protect animals. animal welfare is the ethic that almost everyone that you've ever met actually practices, which is the belief that it is appropriate to use animals so long as they're taken care of responsibly and humanely. And then people in our community are the people who actually develop these standards by working with them, by studying them, by learning how they thrive. What are the best environments for them to live in? What kinds of enrichment should they have? What kinds of human interaction should they have to develop fully and be happy and healthy animals? So that is, I guess, the primary difference is that we believe that responsible animal use is appropriate as long as the animals are well taken care of and that people are continuously educating themselves so they can do a better job.
So what's the overall mission of NAIA? What was it that you were looking to accomplish with this nonprofit?
The mission is just a bunch of words that say we want to do good things for animals. But I think the thing that was the most compelling to me was when we began to work on legislation, seeing how the media had so completely swallowed all of the half-truths and outright lies, misinformation that was being fomented by the animal rights groups. Clearly, there was a ton of money behind them, and they had a plan that was huge in scope, something that we really had not understood at the beginning of all of this. And so our goal basically has been to keep the conversation honest, because if you pass public policy, if you, you know, forget public policy, if you interact with animals in a way that is based on the information or misinformation that's put forth by these ideological groups, you're going to do harm to animals and society. So our job really was to keep the conversation honest, to be able to clarify the complicated issues that are out there, to be able to explain to the public what goes on in various settings, to improve what's going on in those settings when there needs to be improvement. And there's nobody in our community that would say everything that is done with animals, even when it's regulated by the federal government or whatever, is right. There's always room for improvement. Everybody I know is constantly working for more improvement so they can do things better. But in the midst of all that, we are inundated every day with misinformation about animals. We love them. They're in a highly exploitable asset for fundraising groups because people do care about them. My gosh, if you see a picture of an animal on television that has been harmed, it is gut-wrenching for any normal person. And of course, you know, the real sad thing about the messaging, the misinformation, is that it always mischaracterizes the people who work with animals. One of the things that was striking to me when I looked at the research side, and I don't know if you are familiar with the Dr. Taub Silver Springs monkey case. Gosh, it was back in the 80s. And basically, it was one of the first acts of PETA to get some media attention. And so they waited until Dr. Taub was away and they had infiltrated his lab. And while he was gone, the activists that infiltrated it let the place run down. They did things with the animals that no humane animal welfare person would actually do so that they could have some good camera footage for fundraising. I think they're still fundraising on some of the pictures because they were so horrific. And anyway, they attacked him. Basically, all the pictures that they showed, they claimed were the result of what he was doing with these monkeys in his laboratory when in fact, the pictures they showed were all of what happened after he was gone, and they allowed things to deteriorate. And they charged him with everything under the sun, and he had to go through a trial for years. He was finally exonerated of everything. Alec Pacheco, who was co-founder of PETA, was there. He was one of the principals in all of this. And anyway, that was the high-profile case that launched their ascendancy in society. And of course, what do they say? It takes a truth, you know, a long time to catch up with a lie of that size. And it did. It took years and years, destroyed his research for a period of time. Wonderfully, he is a scientist whose research really bore fruit. Some of the things that he was working on have led to people with mobility problems being able to overcome some of their disabilities. Anyway, they are what is called a conflict fundraising organization. Because you got to remember, when you're dealing with the animal rights movement, they aren't making a product. It isn't like they have a retail outlet or that they're selling something online that they manufacture. They also offer almost no services. I think we've all heard stories about PETA's shelter where there's a greater kill of animals than any of the shelters in the same state. So the amount of service that they do is also negligible. What they do is they fundraise, and they fundraise is by defaming other people who live and work with animals. That is their product. With conflict fundraising, you have to have a victim. Say, oh, these poor animals in research, and maybe they mischaracterize how they're being treated, or that they need to be in research at all. We already know all the answers, or we can find the answers in a petri dish. We don't need these animals there at all. They have a lot of different ways of mischaracterizing what's happening in any given setting. So it requires a victim. It requires a villain. The researcher becomes the villain. Whoever it is that is involved with research becomes the villain. The dog breeder becomes the villain. The dairyman becomes the villain. And then they ride into town to save the day because they have all of the noble words and the claims and misinformation to go with it that enables them to raise money. The model for what happened in the United States really started in England. Rod and I wrote a book on this back in 1993, and we did a lot of research. And basically, the animal rights movement is a transplant from the United Kingdom. They worked out this conflict fundraising model there. They would use underground people to go out and do press releases every time. They started by going after hunting groups, but they very quickly started going after laboratories. The British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection was one of the main nonprofit groups that became involved with animal rights from the very beginning. And interestingly enough, the executive director of that group actually came and worked with PETA in the United States for the first few years. But that's where the villain, victim, vindicator model was worked out, where they would make claims about people being villainous in their treatment of animals. They would point to an animal that was in bad shape and claim that it was because of this particular individual or this particular industry. And then they would have their people go out and do press releases and talk about how awful research is or hunting is or whatever it might be. And then they would say, send your money here. They started out as a purely anarchist movement and just doing damage. But if you're doing damage, if you're engaged in violence, if you're engaged in intimidation and so on, it's very difficult for that group to put its name in the newspaper and say, send us money, because they'd wind up also having to go to jail. So what they did is they evolved what they were doing as anarchists into this model that became the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection, where you will see the villain, victim, vindicator model, the conflict fundraising model really establish itself. It is just a transplanted, not only ideology, but also a transplanted way of raising money. So back to why we exist to make sure that the misinformation is countered with factual information. We're also advocates for what we do. We believe that human-animal interaction is a natural thing that's been with us from the very beginning of time, that it's good for people, it's good for pets, it's good for society. So we're going to advocate for a continuation of the human-animal bond in all of its forms.
And it's not just PETA. You know, there's a lot of the national organizations that many of our listeners probably give money to because they think that they really are supporting animal welfare, when in fact they're supporting this ideology you just discussed, and they're still using this conflict fundraising model to generate income, right? So we have PETA, certainly. We have the National ASPCA, the larger group. We have HSUS. We have the White Coat Waste Project. There are a lot of people still doing this. And the thing that gets me is, and you talk about reframing the truth, right? You know, so that the general public understands how they're being exploited and manipulated. But the media seems to be all in on this conflict fundraising model, right? I mean, what you read almost all the time still is reports from the media that basically parrot everything that these groups are saying, right? And then even legislators parroting what they're saying.
For the media, it's eyeballs, because what the activists offer them is sensational images of things that grab the public's attention. I mean, again, it's all based on the fact that we all love animals. That's sort of the irony of the thing, right? This is the most humane culture in the history of the world. We all love animals. We have animals in our life. We are crushed when we see anything bad happen to animals. And this is what they feed the media constantly. It also anchors the opportunity to virtue signal I care more. I care even more than you. So you get into that kind of a situation too. Virtue signaling is a big part of this. The ability of kind people to go, yeah, I believe in that too, really affects culture, really affects politics. You know, lawmakers just want to get reelected. I wish it was deeper than that. I don't want to make a statement that is that all encompassing because I have met absolutely wonderful, sincere Congress members and state representatives and so on that do care deeply. But in general, I think you can say that after lawmakers are there for a while, one of their biggest goals is going to be just to stay there. And they are not immune from the misinformation any more than the general public is. If they believe that their constituency truly wants them to eliminate a particular kind of farming or get rid of dogs in research entirely or whatever the category might be, they're going to go along with that. And they'll even go along with that in the face of corrected information. In my world, we have had as one of the big fundraising issues and one of the biggest true animal welfare issues of the last century, dog overpopulation. As people moved from rural areas where their dogs were running around the property and maybe having their puppies under the front porch or something like that or in the barn, they moved to cities and there was a period of time where people had to learn how to responsibly care for their animals. And we didn't really have spaying and neutering in any numbers until the 60s and 70s. So people were letting their dogs breed. There was an attitude in culture that said, this is just how it is, no big deal. If my dog has a litter of puppies, I'll keep one and I'll take the other six or seven to the shelter and just let them deal with it. And so shelters were just filled to the brim. That was reality for the 60s and 70s. It was starting to get a little better in some places in the 80s as spaying and neutering became available and acceptable to wider numbers of people. By the 90s, we were seeing that there were actually shortages in some parts of the northern states where they'd had animal control and reasonable animal laws on the books for a number of years and where maybe free or low-cost spay neutering had been offered. And by the turn of the century, more and more places were in good shape as far as that goes. And now, well, there's less than 10 states at this point that have a true surplus dog problem, a problem where local dogs are producing more dogs than there's a demand for in that area. And the rest of the states are either in equilibrium, supply and demand are equal, or there's a greater demand than supply. So the fundraising on dog overpopulation started out as something that was very genuine and needed, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. But when surplus dogs were no longer a problem, that fundraising issue remained. And bottom line is that today, I continue to see stories pushing the idea of dog overpopulation. But in fact, most of the northern states don't have enough dogs being produced locally to meet the demand. And so what has happened is many of the same fundraising groups that promote overpopulation as a serious issue are importing dogs from overseas. And when we had the government report done, this is something NAI did. Again, it's part of our fact-finding mission, working with Congress. We attached some language to the Farm Bill in 2018, asking for a government report on the number of dogs that were being imported every year. Turned out it was 1.06 to 1.25 million dogs being imported a year. Those are the ones that could be accounted for. To put it in context, it takes 8 million dogs in the United States just to replace the ones that die every year. So looking at it that way, this number represents an eighth of the entire dog marketplace. So this is a huge number. Again, these are groups that claim as their mission humane treatment of animals. And many of these dogs are coming in from the most horrific breeding situations you can imagine. It would have to be the one in a million outlier in the United States that has a place like that across the board in some of the really poor developing countries, because many of the countries that these dogs are coming in from don't have anything even close to the veterinary care opportunities or public health infrastructure that we have in the United States. And so we've seen everything from rabies to leishmaniasis to various diseases and parasites that are on on the list of diseases that can be spread rapidly to the general population. And so we're trying to get through the Healthy Dog Importation Act, which is a bill that we've been working on. We've been trying to get some reasonable regulations in place so that the dogs need to have a health certificate and they need to be vaccinated for some of the diseases that we've eliminated here in the United States. Certainly rabies is among them.
People hearing this are probably thinking, well, these poor animals are in a bad way over there, right? It's good that we bring them here and we get them healthy. I get that. You know, I feel terribly for the animals. I guess the thing that I also think, though, is if you keep bringing them here without really addressing the problem, then what you've done effectively is you've just created, you know, an established market for continuing to raise dogs in terrible situations, right? And continuing to not address their health concerns and then just shipping them to the United States. And you haven't actually solved the problem. You just created a new one here.
Yeah, if you actually cared, big picture, you would put things in place at the source. You would put in clinics to spay and neuter. You would put in health clinics. You would advocate for various improvements, just like we did in the United States, starting 50 years ago or so with the Animal Welfare Act, right? And they're creating a pipeline rather than a solution for the problem. In some of these countries, young people are being paid a small amount to provide dogs for them. So it's about gathering up street dogs. And, you know, unfortunately, again, your heart goes out to this situation, but street dogs are the most likely reservoir for all these diseases we're talking about because they've had no care. They've been living on their own. They've been living, in some cases, in tropical climates where there are all kinds of things we don't want to have, you know, come to the United States. So, you know, it's exploitation. They're exploiting the people and they're exploiting the animals. There's no doubt about it. But it goes right back to the irony of this whole conversation. Americans love animals. We take care of them better than animals have ever been taken care of in the history of the world. And we are working to do it even better all the time. So we are the ones who care. We are the exploitable assets for this particular kind of enterprise. We are suckers for any sad picture of an animal that we see. We are inclined to just have a visceral response to anyone who we think would harm an animal. And our compassion sometimes doesn't lend itself to see those circumstances too, where both the people and the animals are being victimized by a circumstance. And it's really sad because the fundraising groups don't care at all as long as they're able to get a headline out of the situation. It's an indictment of our whole society, isn't it? That media would be more interested in getting eyeballs than in relaying factual information for the public, that lawmakers would, in many cases, be more oriented toward getting reelected than trying to do work for their constituents that would be beneficial. I mean, unfortunately, that is the culture we live in. The premise of this whole movement is not about loving animals. In fact, very specifically, it's not. If you go back and you read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, which is the book that sort of launched the movement, or at least gave it its philosophical framework, he goes on at some length to point out that this movement is not about loving animals. We don't have that sentimental feeling for animals that most pet owners do. No, we are against all animal use, and we are going to work to eliminate animal use wherever it exists. You have to really understand that. Now, you're not going to be able to sell that premise by saying what it is. You have to go out and exploit the goodwill that people have for animals. That's the only way you're going to succeed, which is not to say that everybody in the animal rights movement doesn't care about animals. I'm sure a lot of them do. There's a crude saying that says the fish stinks from the head. And I think that that's really what you have here. I think an awful lot, maybe 90%, maybe more than that, of the people who are involved with some of these national groups really do care about animals themselves. They have migrated to them thinking that that's what they care about too. I think best case scenario for the national groups is they care about raising money. Money and power go together, and that's what they're after. And those people, some of them probably do care about animals too. It's just that it's not the priority. It is never the priority.
What we learned in the last episode called Sanctuary Straight Talk is that the sanctuaries really aren't all that regulated, right? Now, so you said something before about all the heavy regulations we have here in the United States. And this whole issue has made me think about all of this legislation that we're seeing all over the country attacking pet stores who are working directly with USDA licensed breeders, right? So you have the USDA overseeing all of these breeders. So again, the conflict fundraisers are going after the people who are actually providing healthy pets because they're working working with people that are heavily regulated and overseen by the government. And they're saying instead, like, don't buy pets from these pet stores who have these strong relationships with, you know, really responsible breeders. Don't do that anymore. That's a terrible thing. Get them, you know, from the shelters. Adopt, don't shop. And in fact, the shelters are probably very similar in many cases to the sanctuaries. They aren't as regulated as the pet stores or the breeders providing the pet stores with animals. I mean, can you speak to that?
Yeah, it seems like government officials are very reluctant to regulate nonprofit entities. It puts them into a different lane than they're comfortable operating in. But absolutely, the rescues are in commerce. You know, people forget that probably the biggest number of dogs being placed in the United States today are coming from rescues and shelters. And by the way, I want to say very clearly, I'm not against shelters. My husband and I worked with an advisory board for our Multnomah County Animal Control for many, many years. And every single parent club of the American Kennel Club, 190 breeds, they all have rescue wings. It's something that we actually founded. Probably, again, this is kind of similar to what happened in research where you had people that were ahead of everybody else in trying to institute changes. So rescue has been there, but it wasn't ever marketed the way it has been by the animal rights groups. I mean, we just did it because it was the right thing to do. But we have a different world today, and shelters are the biggest source of dogs and shelters and rescues together, and yet they're totally unregulated. The public doesn't know that. So that is a big part of what NAIA does. We certainly were not in a position to go out and regulate everybody that exists, but the public should be aware that when they get a dog from a rescue or shelter, they should at least be asking where it came from. Did it come from the United States? Did it come from another shelter? Do you know if it came from another shelter, where that shelter got it? Because there's a lot of dog laundering going on right now. For instance, the CDC report in 2018 that talked about over 1 million dogs coming in, about 245,000 of them at that time, and it's grown, were coming across the Mexican border into Texas and Arizona and California and so on. So that's still happening. They're coming across in massive, massive numbers, but they will land at a shelter in your state, in Texas or Oklahoma or Southern California, and then they will be shuttled to another shelter. In my state, there are a couple of shelters that act as the drop-off point, and then those shelters send them to the mega shelters in the big cities. So they can just say, no, I just got it from another shelter. You have to know what's going on in order to ask the question properly. But certainly that's commerce.
Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we have all of these experienced USDA regulated breeders in the United States, and the animal rights groups are telling everyone not to get their animals there. Anybody listening to this now should have deduced who really loves dogs and who really doesn't care as much about dogs as money. And that, of course, brings me to where our previous worlds collided before we became so directly involved with one another and our common goals. There was another fundraising group whose leaders actually hail from the Animal Liberation Front, or at least one directly hails from the Animal Liberation Front, and the other one was a strong supporter of the Animal Liberation Front. And they started a program called the Beagle Freedom Project. And they started going in and adopting research dogs who were offered for adoption because many institutions had open adoption programs, especially those affiliated with vet schools. They would get these dogs and then show up on the state capitals the next day with the cameras. And basically, they were using these animals, our beautiful research animals, who come from these heavily regulated settings, and then lying about their condition. And the whole point was to use our animals as props to demonize research. And as a consequence of that, some of the institutions who adopted these animals out in good faith realized that they were taken advantage of, and that this group, you know, intended to do a lot of harm to research organizations, you know, who were doing the work of the public. So I wanted to start something else, right? I wanted to start a new program, and we wanted to have some say in where our animals went and finding homes for them. And when we wanted to have the opportunity to tell the world what heroes these animals are, right? Instead of using them as props to demonize research, we wanted to show the world that they were ambassadors for treatments and cures, the treatments and cures that we all rely on for ourselves and everyone we love, including our pets. And so I came to you and I said, hey, Patty, you know a lot about dogs, and everybody on your board knows a lot about dogs. Do you think we could create some sort of opportunity to work with NAIA and have a safe place to adopt research dogs through, you know, that the research community could trust, and we'd have an opportunity to actually tell the truth to the public? And I remember you said, oh, yeah, we can do that. Find out how many. anyway, you started the program. You took it and ran with it. And Homes for Animal Heroes is still a program of the National Animal Interest Alliance. And we've placed close to 1,000 dogs at this point. And I'm just so grateful to you. And I've always been curious, but, you know, why did you jump at that, right? Because I want to say something else. It hasn't been a party for you. Your websites are constantly under attack since you started having a very, very strong relationship with the research community. And I think Homes for Animal Heroes played a part in that. Your server was overwhelmed just recently, right? And so you continue to put up with all of this nonsense that is happening, probably from these same groups that don't appreciate the level of transparency that is coming from this program and our messaging to the public, right? So why do you still do it?
First of all, we believe in Homes for Animal Heroes. We believe in the cause. And I know who the bad guys are. I know that no matter what we do, if it's something good that has to do with animals, if it's something that has the potential to expose them, what really happens with Homes for Animal Heroes is it takes away the ability of them to vilify the research community. And I mean, that's the villain, victor, vindicator, that whole conflict fundraising model. It really, really challenges. It shows that the research community absolutely wants to place these dogs and probably always did. But with the activists out there that are going to use every animal that's placed as a prop for their own fundraising goals, it was really hard. And yeah, they come after our computer. They have these programs. I think one's called Brute Force. And there's some other ones too, where they're able to hit your website hundreds of times every minute or maybe every second, whatever it is. It's ridiculous. They just are able to hit you constantly. But we have good protection at this point. I think research is the thing that is their biggest target of all of the different issues. It apparently is the issue that they're able to raise more funds on than anything else. So it's number one, not because the problems are greater there, but because there's more money to be had in that particular sphere. So I don't know what else to say, Cindy. We believe in the program. We want it to grow. We see it growing in the future, and they can just keep coming at us. As far as I'm concerned, it's fine. I expect it.
It means the world to us. So I want you to know how much we really appreciate NAIA and you and how much we love you for that. You know, if the public really wants to help animals, they ought to start redirecting their funds to people who are actually investing in animals and the human-animal bond and preserving our relationships. So I hope everybody heard that. Before we close, I just want to give you an opportunity to share any parting thoughts you have with our listeners, anything that's on your heart.
I would just tell the public to continue loving animals as much as they do today, but to be kind of cautious when they find their emotions aroused by an image of an animal in a sad circumstance. Really check that out. And when they're adopting an animal in particular, they really need to find out the source of that dog. I would say, you know, in a lot of different fields, the tagline is Buy American. I would say that that's a really good one for acquiring a pet at this particular point in time. And I would say go hug a researcher, hug a dairy farmer, hug a dog breeder. Learn what the facts are before you give money to any cause that has to do with animals. And God bless you.
Patty Strand, thank you so very much for everything you've done for animals and people and preserving the human-animal bond and everything you continue to do and everything I know you'll do in the future to change the world, to be more loving and positive. I appreciate you with all my heart.
And we love you back.
Okay, listen. There is nothing, nothing more important to me than the human-animal bond. And I'm pretty sure that most of you feel the same way. The question is this, now that you know what you know, what will you do to protect it? Send me your thoughts at getrealpodcast.info and I'll post them on our social media pages for discussion. And while you're there, please, please, please click on the support link and commit to a small monthly donation. We still have so many things to talk about and I appreciate your engagement. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real. Thanks for joining us today. Up next, how does biomedical research protect us from global threats to our food supply and our economy? Find out on the next episode of Get Real. We'll talk soon.